You are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Liz Olds.
And I'm Annie Harview. Tonight on Right On Radio, Liz Olds talks to Eric M. Johnson, an American journalist, novelist, and outdoorsman. Born and raised in Chicago, he now lives in Seattle, where he writes about Boeing and the billionaire space race for Reuters News. Whenever a Happy Thing Falls is his first novel.
And I'm Josh Weber. In the second part of the show, we'll be featuring one of our legacy interviews, featuring a discussion with an author from the past on the show. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio.
Eric, are you there?
I am.
Oh, great, great. Why don't you start with your reading?
Great. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate
the introduction. So I am going to be reading two scenes from my book where the protagonist, who's a young recent graduate, and he's working at an investment banking firm, and he's increasingly confronting the misogyny and the racism and the greed and a toxic culture. And he starts confronting the other bankers and challenging them on it. And so these will be two examples of that. 3:01 p.m., the Chicago Tribune reported a hostage situation at Ogilvy train station on Madison Avenue, where Fredericks, Bale's boss, caught his train to the suburbs. Bale went to inform him. Fredericks, hostage situation, madman with guns at Ogilvy. Fredericks didn't even nod his head. Yeah, the trains are all backed up. Frederick, there's a man slaying people in the train station. I think there are a couple dead already. He's holding others hostage inside an emptied out corner bakery. Right. Yes, I saw, Frederick said. Aren't you bothered by this? Bale said. Frederick stopped typing. He made a quarter turn so Bale could see his pockmarked cheek twitching. There is always some wacko or fundamentalist shooting or blowing something up, he said. The question is, how will it affect me? In a sense, of course, that has to be the most basic initial reaction to violence, Bale said. But don't you care that people are dying? People I never met, Frederick said. Yes. No, man, I don't. I prefer they didn't. But I can't control anything in my life except my own actions. I just try to put my head down and get on with it. He swiveled around in his chair to face Bale. Look, my dad was a road construction worker. Paved roads and flag cars all around Dubuque. One day, a maniac driver mowed down his entire work crew on Route 20. He was the only one that survived. He was away on break finishing a cigarette. Afterward, he didn't donate blood or move to an ashram in India or even change jobs. He walked in the front door, sat down at dinner, and said, "Meatloaf again, Martha?" 1:27 a.m. The 15 books were collated, bound, stacked, shimmering in the glare of corporate fluorescent lighting. They both stood there, McAllister and Bale, with their arms wrapped around their chests, looking at their creation. McAllister was Bale's other boss. All right, McAllister said, let's go through them. Bale grabbed a stack and plopped them on the filing cabinet. McAllister stared at the larger pile of remaining books and grew irate over his assumption that Bale was slyly trying to offload work on a higher-ranking associate. Don't be a Jew, McAllister said, grabbing the remaining books and dumping them on Bale's pile. What the hell, man? Bale said. What the hell what? McAllister said, reaching for the pile. Without thinking, Bale swiped McAllister's arm away from the pile, saying, why are you saying racist stuff to me? McAllister shoved his arm down and stepped an inch from Bale's face. Bale shoved him back, but McAllister quickly grabbed two fistfuls of Bale's shirt and flung him up against the filing cabinet, causing a green potted plant to fall and shatter on the carpeting. They clawed at each other, veins jumping out over their ruby skulls as they flailed and cursed and spit. McAllister swung Bale toward another cabinet, which he slammed into. tearing his shirt from nape to waist. Both McAllister and Bale's eyes grew wide at the gashing sound, and they instantly stopped fighting. McAllister rested his palms on his knees, panting as Bale grappled with the back of his shirt to appraise the damage. They took seats on the carpet beside each other. McAllister leaned his skull against the cabinet. Bale cracked his knuckles. They both knew the fight was about more than just a slur. The difference was that McAllister didn't care. For Bale, in that moment, it seemed as if all of American life boils down to an endless war between spitefully evil bastards and those trying to marginally disrupt their influence.
Great. That's Eric Johnson reading some excerpts from Whenever a Happy Thing Falls, his new novel. Bale kind of goes back and forth between investment banking and wanting to be a writer. Why don't you talk a little bit about how you put that together and what your thoughts are about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the book, basically, when you first encounter him chronologically, he's in London and he's studying poetry and fiction, and he's working at a newspaper, and he's dating. He has a budding romance with an amazing, beautiful, precocious actress, and everything's great. And then his father issues him an ultimatum and just says, "Listen, in life, you have to choose economic security. You have to take a serious job. You have to get yourself together." And the father's got some ulterior motives there that I don't really want to get into because it gives away too much. But the bottom line is he's torn, like a lot of young people, onto this question of whether he should be following his passions or whether there's some sort of set specific track that he should be on that's going to give him a safer life. And so in the book, structurally, I pivot between him at this crushing, stressful, dramatic, tense job at the investment bank, and then I pivot to London, where you see him in this other life and really enjoying himself. And we switch back and forth as the tension builds to a sort of a climax. And then he decides, okay, the central tension in the book really is, can he find a way to extract himself from this culture? Or is he at risk of actually becoming one of these people? And separately, can he find a way to maybe change the culture and go and follow his passions? And so the drama builds and builds and builds until he escapes one day and flees to his family's rural cabin in Michigan to sort of appraise the situation and figure out what he's going to do and how he's going to save his own life.
And what exactly does the title mean?
Whenever a Happy Thing Falls. So it's actually taken from a line in Rilke. It's and we who have always thought of happiness as rising would feel the emotion that almost overwhelms us whenever a happy thing falls. And so it's a Rilke poem from the Duino Elegies. And I was just always drawn to that because if you're looking at the cover of the book, there's a picture of a dancer, and he's executing what's called a balan, which is one of the most incredibly athletic, difficult moves in dance, where the dancer appears suspended in the air. And the mom in the book named him after that dance move because she really wanted him to muster the strength to get away from his father's toxic grasp. And so that's where that comes from.
Okay. Now, how do I ask this question? There's like three parts to it. I'm curious how you know so much. Yeah, really. You probably know about that, being a journalist. How do you know so much about investment banking? But also, is it based on your own experiences? And what prompted you to write this book?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think I graduated college and I studied economics and English, and I just made a wrong choice personally. I chose a job working at an investment bank in Chicago. And so, you know, I mean, I am a journalist, and so even while I was at the bank, I actually kept a little notebook and was writing down some of the things that the colleagues would say. And so I kind of amassed this material. And for me, actually, I was trying to think of the exact moment when I decided you know, look, this is not for me. This is the wrong culture, and I want to be a writer. I'm passionate about writing. I love writing. And I was in the bank, and it was, you know, on my 85th hour of work, and I got a call from a college friend who said that a guy we played soccer with on our team had died unexpectedly in one of these freak, tragic accidents. And one of the colleagues at the bank overheard this conversation and asked me about it afterwards. And I told him what happened to my friend, and he just burst out laughing. And he just said, you know, what an idiot. And I literally grabbed my yellow legal pad, went directly to a bar overlooking the Chicago River, and wrote down what would become one of the first scenes in the book, where McAllister, the associate, comes into the office at 7 a.m. and finds Bale, the protagonist, literally sleeping on the floor after pulling his third all-nighter. And, you know, I became quickly disillusioned with that world. You know, look, I still have friends in that world. I'm not here to say all bankers are evil. I wasn't trying to write an Upton Sinclair, you know, jungle type expose. But I do think that the industry, the financial industry, you know, is wrestling with a lot of the questions that we're wrestling with in America: gender pay inequality, racism, homophobia, you know, and these sort of questions. And I was in that culture and I saw those things, and I know that things need to change. And so, you know, look, I didn't last very long in that industry. I actually quit in a spectacular fashion. Only a couple weeks after I wrote those first few pages, I threw my phone into the Chicago River and then went right into the office of the head of investment banking. And I said, listen, this is not for me. I'm out. And went and wrote the draft of my novel. And so I drew inspiration from it. And you'll see a lot of that in the book.
It's interesting that you threw your phone away. One of my colleagues and I were talking about how we were talking about all the work that you guys did, the many hours that you put in. And we decided that because one always has a phone with them, that they're always on. You never get a moment where you're away from that, and so you can always be found and always called in to work another 20.
Totally. And as a journalist, you know that. You're always checking your phone. There's always another Twitter post. And I just think, like, especially during COVID, I mean, we all just need to find ways to get away, you know, and get away from our technology. And I mean, I'm literally talking to you in the middle of Idaho, where I drove from Seattle to go fly fishing. And I'm just, you know, like you said, I'm going to turn the phone off and spend a few days rowing down the river, and that's it, you know. So it's definitely weighing on people, you know.
Yes, it is. Cool. Totally personal question. Where in Idaho are you?
I am actually in St. Marie's, Idaho.
Okay.
Are you familiar with Northern Idaho?
Oh, yes. I went to school in Moscow.
Oh, my God. Oh, no kidding. Well, so I drove to St. Regis, Montana to fish the Clark Fork, but by the time we got there, it was like muddy, so we had to pivot, and then we drove back, and now we're in St. Marie's. So it's gorgeous here. I mean,
it's beautiful. Okay, well, enough personal stuff.
You didn't call to talk about fly fishing.
No. The men in this novel are pretty sexist and racist and homophobic and cutthroat. Kind of like Mad Men on steroids is what it made me think of.
Wow.
Is it really that bad? Is it really that bad?
Well, look, I wanted to take a journalistic approach to this novel. I a lot of the characters are composites, but I drew on real world experience. I absolutely, you know, exaggerated and embellished a few things for dramatic flair, of course. And look, you know, I gave you kind of some of the worst characters, right? A lot of people in finance are just, you know, regular people, you know, putting in their time, trying to make a living, you know, families, all the normal stuff. But, you know, the strange thing about humans is, you know, it's the worst of us that sometimes have the biggest impact on the world. The worst of us are filled with passionate intensity, as Yeats put it. And so that I captured some of that. But look, I didn't want to write a sad book. I really don't want people to think that. There's romance in this book, and the character is on a journey to get away from this world. And he's got, you know, this romance that he has with the girl. He's got a best friend who is his moral compass and is helping him through plotting a way out to do it. It's a redemption story, right? Bale, at the end, has to figure out a way to make things right. He has to get himself out of this culture, and maybe there's ways that he can change the culture. And I don't want to give away too much, but he does figure out a way to have a meaningful impact there. Mm-hmm. And also, there's a homeless man in downtown Chicago that he sort of befriends as he's watching this very materialistic, greed-fueled life, and he starts befriending this homeless man, and he figures out a way to help him. And I keep kind of chipping away towards the end of it, but it's a green ending, it's a positive ending, and it's really hopeful.
Yeah, it's kind of the hero's journey, really.
Exactly. Absolutely.
So more on a you level, a lot of novelists start out as journalists and vice versa, and I'm wondering which you like more.
Oh man, that is a really tough question. Oh, well, listen, this is my first book, and I have to tell you that writing it was, as everybody knows, it's a difficult process. It takes years and revisions and all that. But I will tell you that the last 40 pages, pulling it all together in the way that I tried to do, I'm just really proud of it, and I really think that it gave me such a great feeling, and I'd love to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you don't, as a writer, you know, you don't always get that feeling. You know, you write a story and it's great and you move on to the next one, but there's something about novel writing that is really special.
Mm-hmm.
And just a personal story on that is, you know, I didn't grow up writing. I wasn't like the Truman Capote where I'm writing short stories when I'm 4 years old, right?
Mm-hmm,
I was into sports, and I was okay in school, but I never really got into reading and writing until later. And it was really my last 2 years of high school when I had a wonderful teacher who really, really took me to task. And he said, listen, you have a voice and you have a story to tell, and you're wasting your own time and you're wasting my time, and I want you to take this seriously. And at the time, we were reading, it was 20th century British literature, so we were reading, you know, Joyce, Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, we were reading Yeats, and he really pushed me and ignited a fire within me on writing. And the tragic part of it was that, you know, he helped me with my writing and we were friends, and he actually died my senior year. And so it was a real difficult period, but I thought, okay, he set me on this path, I'm just so glad that I got this done almost for him, I'm definitely going to keep writing fiction. And journalism, as you know, I mean, it's thrilling and exciting, and I get to write about Boeing and corporate crises, and I get to write about Elon Musk and rockets, and, you know, it's I love all of it, really. But I think fiction, I definitely have more to do on fiction.
I'm curious, you talked about drafts and time and whatnot. How many drafts and how long did this one take you?
Well, so after I quit my job in banking in a spectacular fashion, my wife, but at the time my girlfriend and I, we moved to Zagreb, Croatia, and I got to spend the year writing the first draft of this book. And I was living the total writer's life in Europe, right? I was in the cafes and I was drinking in the clubs and I was spending all day reading and writing and, you know, smoking cigarettes and all that. And I came back to the States, and it was crazy. I immediately got an agent. I was, you know, in the throes of doing revisions. And then, of course, I mean, nothing can be that easy in fiction. The agent decided to quit the big New York agency, and none of the other agents were looking to take on new writers. And so, I basically shelved it for a couple years and came back to it. And then, you know, I worked on it really, you know, I wrote another draft. So maybe, you know, a couple, three drafts, but it took a long time. And you just have to stick with it. You know, everybody knows that, right? But you know, I found a great editor in Mary Wisniewski, a Chicago journalist, and another East Coast editor, Victoria Stahl, who helped me get the book in shape, and a great publisher. So it happens. You just have to, it's really a grueling process, no matter who you are.
What about the techniques? Do you get your butt in the chair every day? You go down to the cafe and smoke a few cigarettes? I mean, what is your technique to do the writing?
Right. It's so funny because I have the exact opposite experience now as a full-time professional journalist and a father with a four-year-old and an 18-month-old and a wonderful supportive life. So I don't have the leisurely reading in the park type writing environment that I had one time. So you carve out time whenever you can. You know, if an idea comes to you, you pull over and you type on your iPhone, you go for long walks, whatever you can do to find that time. And I'm very lucky to do it. And, you know, it's just a matter of, look, if it's a passion, if it's something, you know, I write because I'm compelled to do it. I'm obsessed with it. I can't not do it. And so I'm kind of lucky in that way that I don't have the struggle to, you know, go on a big retreat or having to go get an MFA. I can just do it on my own time whenever I can.
Yeah, I just want to go back and make a remark about something you said before. Isn't it amazing to have a good teacher?
Oh, my God. I mean, I am in no position to give advice. I'm a first-time novelist, and, you know, you've talked to some very, you know, very accomplished people. But I have to say, finding people who are geniuses that you trust, and whether that's a teacher, whether that's an editor, whether that's a friend, finding someone you can share your writing with and get feedback to get out of your own head, and that's crucial. And I think also structure. I think it's really not said enough that, you know, literally if you can write out the framework of the structure of the story that you want to tell, it just makes the writing process so much easier. I mean, the story might change, the characters are going to change, but if you know where you're going with it, it's like Bob Dylan said, I knew my song before I started singing.
Mm.
If you can do that, that's the only other thing I would say.
Cool. Well, we have a couple minutes left, just a couple. What have you got in the hopper next?
Ooh, in the hopper. So I have another idea for a novel. I've got some short stories I'm working on. But I have to say, I mean, fingers crossed, a couple production companies are reading it for potentially optioning it.
Oh.
So, I mean, I would love to write the screenplay or at least collaborate on it if I can. So, you know, we'll kind of see, you know, but right now I'm just absolutely loving this moment, right? Getting to talk to people like you and share the book. I hope people like it. I hope it resonates with people. And yeah.
Cool. Well, we have to go. We've been talking with Eric Johnson about his novel, Whenever a Happy Thing Falls. And it's been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much, Eric.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Take care. And now this.
I squat down by the body and carefully, one-fingered, hook her hair back from her face. Steve moves in beside me. She's somewhere under 30. She was pretty before someone decided to turn the left side of her jaw into a bloody purple lump. No stunner, but pretty enough. And she worked hard at it. She has on a truckload of makeup, the full works and done right. Her nose and her chin would be little girl cute, only they have that jutting look that comes with long-term, low-level starvation. Her mouth, hanging open, showing small bleached teeth and clotted blood, is good. Soft and full, with a droop to the bottom lip that looks witless now, but was probably appealing yesterday. Under the three blended shades of eyeshadow, her eyes are slit open, staring up into a corner of the ceiling. I say, I've seen her before. Steve's head comes up fast. Yeah? Where? Not sure. I've got a good memory. Steve calls it photographic. I don't, because I'd sound like a tosser, but I know when I've seen someone before, and I've seen this woman. She looked different then. Younger, but that could have been because she had more weight on her. Not fat exactly, but soft, and a lot less makeup. Careful foundation, a shade darker than her skin, thin mascara at the end. Her hair was brown and wavy then, done up in a clumsy twist. Navy skirt suit, a touch too tight. high heels that made her ankles wobble, grown-up clothes for some big occasion. But the face, the gentle snub nose, a soft droop of the bottom lip, those were the same. She was standing in sunlight, swaying forward towards me, palms coming up, high voice with a tremble in it, but please, I really need... And me, blank-faced, leg twitching with impatience, thinking, pathetic. She wanted something from me. Help? Money? A lift? Advice? I wanted her gone. Steve says, work? Could have been. The blank face took willpower. On my own time, I would have just told her to get lost. He says, we'll run her through the system as soon as we get back to HQ. If she came in with a domestic violence complaint... I never worked, Davey. Would have had to be back when I was in uniform, and I shake my head. I don't remember anything like that. See, I wouldn't have been itching to get rid of her. Not if she'd been getting the slaps. The slit-open eyes give her face a sly look, like a kid cheating at hide-and-seek.
Very good.
Is that all right?
Well, go ahead.
Sorry?
I'm sorry. Was that the end, or were you going to keep going?
Yeah, no, that's the end. I didn't know until 5 minutes ago that you needed a passage, so I couldn't grab the first thing. Is that enough?
Yeah, no, that's great. That's great. You've been listening to Tana French reading from her new novel, The Trespasser, now out in paperback. She is also the author of In the Woods, The Likeness, Faithful Place, Broken Harbor, and The Secret Place. Among her awards are the Edgar Award, the McCavity, the Anthony, the Barry, the Los Angeles Times Award for Best Mystery Thriller, and the Irish Book Award for Crime Fiction. Tana French, welcome to Write on Radio.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, tell us a little bit about the story before we go too far into it. It's essentially a murder mystery.
Yeah, it is. It's the narrator, Detective Antoinette Conway, who's on Dublin's murder squad, and she is not getting on well there. She's kind of a tough cookie. She's hard-edged, she's abrasive, she doesn't play well with others, and she got off on the wrong foot in the squad. Things spiraled from there, and now she's at the receiving end of a campaign of harassment, everything from basically humiliating pranks to straight-out sabotage. And she and her partner get a case that, at first glance, looks like a standard lover's tiff. It's a young woman dead in her home next to a table set for a romantic dinner for two. Looks like the boyfriend came over, something went wrong, he punched her, the end. But as they investigate, they realize that one of their own squad is in way too much of a hurry for them to arrest the boyfriend, close the case, and move on. And they have to figure out, is this just lazy policing, or is it part of a campaign to get rid of Antoinette, to get her to make such a huge mistake that she'll be booted off the squad, or is there something deeper and darker going on?
Mm-hmm. And essentially, this is a character study of two women. One is Antoinette Conway, and one is your victim, Aislinn Murray, and they both share a lot of similarities.
Yeah, they share similarities, but also some major differences. For both of them, they both grew up with an absent father. Antoinette's went missing but he did a runner, basically, when her mother was still pregnant with her. And Aisling's vanished one day when Aisling was only 10. But they've dealt with that in very different ways. Antoinette has dealt with it by deciding that there is no way that this fact is going to define her life in any way. The fact of her father, who he was, the fact that he's gone, is not going to make any difference to who she is, what she does. She never even thinks about him. Whereas Aisling allowed her father's disappearance to define her life, everything that she was and did. But as the book continues, Antoinette's kind of forced to confront the fact that her father's absence has, in fact, defined the way that she relates to the world in ways that she didn't really want to admit to herself, and that she's going to need to do something about that.
Yeah, she seems to constantly be spoiling for a fight, and part of that is, as you mentioned, the harassment that she gets from the murder squad. But it seems that part of it is just this general anger at the world brought about by the disappearing father.
She's very defensive, and yeah, as you say, constantly looking for a fight. And part of it is that she's grown up, you know, the only mixed-race kid in a very, very white environment. She's the only woman on a male squad. But part of it's just her. Because of that early experience with her father, she's so determined that no one will ever define who she is, that she's constantly lashing out at people who aren't necessarily trying to do any such thing. She has this narrative in her head where she is the lone warrior fighting against enemies from all sides, you know, going down fighting. And in the course of the book, she kind of has to realize that that narrative may not be entirely consistent with the reality. It's not completely made up from scratch, but it may not be entirely what's actually going on.
Yeah, and that's another thing that you bring up during the course of the novel. You mentioned this several times throughout the book, that people create stories in their own heads. Of course, they're always the heroes of their own stories. And that plays a big role, not just for Antoinette, but for Ashlyn and for a number of other characters as well.
Yeah, at its heart, that's kind of what the book is about, the fact that we do create narratives of our own lives. And what happens when those narratives don't completely match the reality? Do we try to adjust the narrative in order to match reality, or do we try to force reality to adapt to match the narrative? And what happens when that self-created narrative gets completely out of control? It can be dangerous.
Mm-hmm. And so you have initially the boyfriend, who is not really a boyfriend yet. He's just somebody that she started seeing, this Rory, who they haul in, and they start essentially harassing him to try to get him to confess to this crime.
Yeah, they're at first pretty certain. He's as obvious as it gets. He was at the crime scene at the relevant time. He's the partner, though the boyfriend or girlfriend or spouse is always the prime suspect in anything like this. He seems like the obvious guy. And he's also clearly at least minorly obsessed with Ashlyn, so he does seem like the obvious one. But there are little things, like Antoinette knows she's seen Ashlyn somewhere before. There's too much pressure on them. Ashlyn's best friend is hinting that Ashlyn had a secret boyfriend. There are too many little things that Antoinette doesn't want to leave as loose ends. And the further they follow them, the stranger and more convoluted the story gets, and the less simple the answer seems to be.
So was there a specific inspiration for this novel, or is this just something that you came up with out of your head without some external real-world event that pulled you into it?
No, there was a real-world event. I'm lucky. I know a retired detective who over the last 10 years has answered just a ridiculous number of questions about every aspect of like police life and police procedure. And he's a really lovely guy, and I owe him a lot. And a few years ago, I rang him up and I said, come here, would you tell me, how would you go about interviewing a suspect in this specific set of circumstances? And he said, oh, yeah, sure, I'll shoot. And he gave me a quick demonstration of how he would do that, using me as a hypothetical suspect. Mm. And it was a revelation, just like that, like turning on a dime. He switched from this really genuinely lovely guy who I'd known for years to this unstoppable force. It wasn't exactly that he was being aggressive. It was just that he was going to get what he was after in this conversation, and nothing I could do was going to get in his way. And it kind of blew me back in my chair. I was on the phone. He was doing me a favor, but it felt like it was a train coming at you. And I started to think about what it would be like to work in an environment where everybody around you has this skill, has this other mode available to them, because it's a necessary part of a detective skill set. And what would happen if that went a bit wrong and that turned in on itself, turned on its own? What would it be like to be surrounded in your own work environment, the environment where you're supposed to be safe and powerful and strong, with this force being turned on you constantly? And when I started thinking about this book and about Antoinette, who I'd already set up in Secret Place as being somebody who wasn't quite getting on well with her squad, I thought of her in that context and how she would respond to that pressure being turned up, and what it would do to her sense of herself and reality and herself within the squad. So it kind of sprang out of that.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, she's mentioned in The Secret Place, it's essentially Steve's book, her partner's book. He's the narrator, Stephen Moran, in that book. And she's the partner. That's an interesting approach that you have used, different narrators in different books. I found Antoinette to be, in some ways, a lot more compelling than Steve. I mean, she's a more tortured figure in many ways than Steve is. He seems much more happy-go-lucky and not quite so tormented by the world around him. Is that how you felt, too? Did you feel that she was a little more interesting in some ways than Steve, or does he have his own charms that you liked?
No, I think definitely she's more interesting. She was more interesting to write, and I would bet that she's more interesting to read, because somebody who's torn and struggling is always going to be more interesting. Like a completely happy, at peace narrator, it's like watching a guy sit on his couch with an Xbox and a bowl of Doritos. It's nice. It's lovely that he's happy, but I don't necessarily want to watch him for a few hours. You know, what you want from a narrator is somebody who's struggling, who's trying to get somewhere, who's fighting their way through something. And I don't think it's not coincidence that Steve, who is the most kind of at peace and undamaged of all my narrators, is also the only one who doesn't get the whole book. The narration switches back and forth between him and other characters in the third person. Because I don't think somebody who's as basically chilled out and okay as that would really be interesting enough to sustain a whole book.
Yeah.
Whereas Antoinette is kicking and struggling and clawing the whole way. And that is more interesting to watch, because we're all struggling with stuff in our own ways, in different ways. And one of the things I think we need from a book is to see a character do that, and to see that progression, that movement.
Yeah, right. And I had forgotten that Steve is not the narrator throughout the entire book of The Secret Place. I was thinking it was his book all the way through. But now when you mention that, I remember that's right. He isn't solely the narrator there. So is this Antoinette a character that you might come back to, or do you want to try to continue to pursue other characters in other works?
I might come back to her at some stage. I never rule it out, because I don't know when a story might come up that matches with a previous character. But at the moment, I'm working on something that's kind of different. All of my previous narrators, they've all been detectives. They've all been on the murder squad. They've all been interlinked to some extent. And with the exception of Steve, they've all been pretty damaged characters with stuff from their past that needs working through. But this time, the narrative, the one I'm working on, he's not a detective. He's not, at the beginning of the book anyway, he's got no real problems. He's a happy guy with a happy life, until one day two burglars break into his house and beat him up pretty badly. And in the wake of that, when he's in a really bad state, mentally, at least as much as physically, he finds himself in the middle of a cold case murder investigation. And he has to figure out, with kind of what's left of his mental and emotional resources, not just what to do about it, but also how he got there in the first place.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. Well, let's return to this book, and let's talk a little bit about Ashlyn, because we get to listen to Antoinette talk about her experience firsthand, but we have to learn about Ashlyn through other people, through Antoinette looking into her, or through her best friend, or through Rory. Somebody else has to provide the information about her life. So you're delving into these two different lives, but you're doing it in two very different ways.
That's one of the big difficulties with writing murder mystery, is that the victim is this crucial person at the heart of the entire book, and yet you, without being doing seriously contrived devices, you almost never have a way to show this person through his or her own eyes. And it's a really difficult thing to get around, because you don't want the murder victim to sort of vanish into the sidelines as a sort of prop that you dump in there in order to get the action flowing. And yet you don't really have a way to give that person a voice. It has to be a secondhand voice. And in this book in particular, there's a kind of irony to that, because it's a book about what happens when somebody tries to rewrite someone else's narrative? What happens when somebody else is trying to force you into a certain role that suits their narrative, trying to shape your story in order to suit theirs? And the different ways that people respond to that or react to that or fight against it or go along with it. And Aisling is one of the characters who, in the end, fights most passionately and intensely and with the most dedication against having her story taken over by anyone else. And yet in this book, by the nature of it, her story is only told through other people. And of course, some of them aren't going to know the truth or are going to be reshaping the truth to suit themselves. But I tried, the nearest I could do was make her best friend, in some ways, one of the most clear-sighted characters within the book. I mean, inevitably, her view is slightly skewed because there's a strong implication that she was probably in love with Aisling since they were kids. So that's going to give her a slightly different take on all the action and on Aisling herself. But I wanted to make her sincere and clear-sighted to an extent about Aisling, because that's the only way that Aisling herself, if she was, would get any space within this book, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I noticed that you, I mean, I think you did a great job of portraying Aisling through, is it Josie? I can't remember now, Lucy's eyes.
Lucy, yeah.
And so we see how she's perceived by others in a way that seems, as you mentioned, very clear. And even where it's not clear, Antoinette is sharp enough to realize, okay, this is shaded or filtered by Lucy because of this or that or whatever. So she does a very good job of sort of translating for the reader the reality of Aisling, and eventually, of course, comes to remember where it is that she has seen Aisling before, which helps her to also define Aisling in her own mind.
Yeah, and to an extent, it helps her to realize that she has, in fact, played a role in this case long before it ever happened. She had a small part in taking events to where they wound up. But I think also, if you're going to try and portray someone secondhand, having them portrayed from several angles helps. Like, you get Aisling via Lucy, the best friend, via Antoinette, who's met her before, via her boyfriend Rory, via other characters who have run into her along the way. And you can kind of triangulate and try and get a clear image of her through all these different characters.
The other thing that I noticed about this story is that it's in many ways a story of Ireland, and yet in many ways it's a universal story. So there's this immediacy and geographical sort of smallness to it. At the same time, there's this large universality to it. You know, people are all kind of the same around the world, and so you have to sort of define it in terms of where the setting is, but at the same time enlarge it so that everyone can sort of feel like that's our world too.
I think those two things tend to go hand in hand for me, at least in the books I've read. The ones that are the most universal do tend to be the most grounded in setting, whether it's a real setting or an imaginary one. It's very detailed and very grounded, and I think it's because that's the way we experience life, is in its very specific textures, in, you know, the sounds of a specific place, the dialects of a specific place, the atmosphere of a very specific place and time. And so if you want to make something universal, you have to acknowledge that aspect of universal experience, which is that we live very much through a context, and the context shapes experience.
And some of your books have this aspect of magical realism. This one does not, but I remember The Secret Place, for example. There's just a little bit of the fantastic about it. What is it that pulls you to do that in some books and to stay away from it in others? Is it just the story that you're trying to tell, and sometimes that element just sort of comes out?
It's more about the narrator. Like, the world of the books, because I'm writing first person, the world of the books is totally shaped by the narrator and who he or she is and how they see the world. So some narrators have a predisposition or a draw towards that kind of liminal or magical realism feeling. Like, it's present in the woods, because Rob Ryan, the narrator of that one, has a, for him, reality is very tenuous. It's kind of fractured and dangerous, and it doesn't stay solid under his feet. And so that's the world of the book. Whereas in The Trespasser, for example, or in Faithful Place, reality is a solid thing. There will be none of this messing around from the character's point of view. For the narrator, all this supernatural nonsense has absolutely no place in their world. And so it doesn't come into the book in any way.
Yeah.
I think the world of the book is very much the narrator's world.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing you do that I find interesting and fascinating and I really enjoyed is that you really take your time with conversations. You know, most mysteries and thrillers, the conversations are 2, 3, 4 pages long at most. And that isn't the way they really were, particularly, as you mentioned, like when your detective friend was sort of grilling you and being relentless. It just goes on and on and on. And you're willing to do that. You're willing to stay in that scene for a long time until we get to whatever it is, whatever nugget is going to emerge from that.
It's a hard balance, I'm telling you, because you don't want to go too far into realism and end up with like an 8-hour interrogation scene, every phrase on the page. You know, yeah. Readers at a certain point are going to go off and like get lunch or something.
Yeah.
But at the same time, what I find fascinating is interactions between people. That's where the real mysteries happen, and the texture of interactions. But this is what fascinates me, is people and how they interact. So you don't want to just pare it back to the bare basics. Did you do this crime? No. Well, here's evidence that you did. Oh, no, I confess. You know, you don't want to pare it back too far either.
Right.
You want to give it space to unfold. You want to give the characters space to open up into that conversation. It's a hard balance to find. I'm not sure I always get it right. I think the length of the book says that I might kind of err on the side of too much.
Yeah, well, and it's probably better to err on that side than leave something out. You know, there's the whole debate about style versus story. Raymond Chandler was famous for saying, I don't really care about the story. I'm much more concerned with the style. But you want to try to blend the two together so that you've got the best of both worlds.
You want to integrate them so that the style matches with the story and the story matches with the style. But for whatever reason, I just always seem to have big, long ideas. I don't do succinct well. I have other gifts, but succinct is not high on that list.
Well, we're out of time, so we're going to have to leave it at that. But it's been wonderful chatting with you. I really enjoyed your book. This is Steve McKellistrom speaking with Tana French about her new novel, The Trespasser, now out in paperback. Tana French, thanks for being on Right on Radio.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, and now this.
To Right on Radio, KFAI, on Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Liz Olds. I'd like to thank our guest, Eric M. Johnson, plus our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and information about Right on Radio at KFAI.org/program/Right on Radio. Plus, listen to recent episodes on our recently launched podcast found on Spotify, iTunes, and anywhere podcasts can be found. Now stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota.
Thank you.